If there's going to be any serious trouble, it's going to come down this road alongside the river from the terrorist camp near the airstrip here and here. Sergeant Major Gondila will lead the support unit up the river in the other three boats and set up a roadblock to prevent any gooks coming through. You will have to hold there for 30 minutes after you hear the first shot fired. That'll give us time to spring the prisoners. Then you pull out and get back downriver and hotfoot out to sea to rendezvous with Lancer. It's simple and it must be quick. We aren't going to hang around a second longer than necessary, but if you can sort out a few of the uglies while you're about it, nobody's going to complain. Okay, now we'll go over it again in detail, and tomorrow we'll practice launching the boats and recovering them again in rough weather. We'll do that every day, plus weapons drill and equipment checks. You aren't going to have much time to ride home before we hit the beach on the night of Tuesday the 13th. Keep that date open. Write it down. The commercial flight landed at Kinshasa in the middle of a tropical downpour. Rainwater cascaded down the windows as the aircraft taxied to its berth, and Isabella was soaked in the few seconds that it took to leave the aircraft and board the airport bus. As she had been promised, there was someone to meet her as she came through the customs and immigration barrier. He was a good-looking young pilot in plain khaki flying overalls without any insignia or rank. When he greeted her in Spanish, she was able to detect the Cuban accent, now that she knew to listen for it. He insisted on carrying her suitcase and the box of gifts for Nicky, and flirted with her brazenly in the ramshackle taxi that drove them from the main airport building down to the private and charter section of the airfield. By the time they got there, the rain had stopped. Although heavy clouds still covered the sky, it was stiflingly hot and humid. He loaded her luggage into the back compartment of a small single-engine aircraft. She did not recognize the type. It carried no insignia other than an enigmatic number, and was painted an overall drab, sandy colour. "Are we going to fly in this weather?" she asked him. "Isn't it dangerous?"
"Ah, Signora, if you die, you will die in my arms. What a glorious passing!"
As soon as they were airborne, he placed his hand on her thigh, the better to point out the passing scenery. "Keep your hands on the wheel, keep your eyes on the road," she lifted his hand and gave it back to him. He flashed his teeth and his eyes, and laughed as though he had made a conquest. She could not remain angry for long. Every minute they kept on this heading confirmed the fact that she was being taken to the base where last she had seen Nicky. 2 hours later, she made out the grey expanse of the Atlantic beneath the lowering cloud banks ahead. The pilot turned south along the coast, and then she sat up straight in the seat, and her spirits took wing. She recognized the oxbows in the river and the open mouth to the sea. The pilot pulled on flap and lined up for a landing on the red clay strip. "Nicky," she thought, "soon now, my baby, soon we'll be free again." As they taxied in, she saw him. He was standing on the front seat of the jeep. He had shot up at least another 2 inches, and his legs seemed too gawky and coltish for his body. His hair was longer than she remembered, and curled out from under his camo cap. But his eyes were the same, that marvellous clear green that sparkled even at this distance. As soon as he recognised her behind the windscreen, he waved both hands over his head, and his teeth flashed in the darkly tanned and beautiful face. In the jeep with him were the driver and José, the Cuban paratrooper. They were grinning as widely as Nicky as she climbed out of the front seat of the aircraft. Nicky jumped out of the jeep and ran to meet her. For a heady moment she thought he might rush into her arms. Then he got control of himself and offered her his hand. "Welcome, Mama." She thought the strength of her love might choke her. "It is good to see you again." "Hello, Nicky." Her voice was husky. "You've grown so much, I hardly recognized you. You're becoming a man now."
It was the right thing to say. He hooked his thumbs into his belt and called imperiously to José and the driver.
"Come and take my mother's luggage."
"Right away, General Pele." José gave him a mock salute, and then to Isabella, "Greetings, Signora. We have been looking forward to your visit." "I'm everybody's favourite aunt now," Isabella thought cynically. From her box of goodies, she gave José and the driver each a 200 pack of Marlboro cigarettes, and her popularity was enhanced 100-fold. In Angola, Western cigarettes were hard currency. As Nicholas drove them down to the beach, he chatted happily,
and though she showed flattering interest in everything he had done and achieved since their last meeting, she was checking her surroundings with a much more businesslike eye than she had previously. She realized that she had made serious errors in the sketch map that she had drawn for Sean. The training base had been enlarged since her last visit. There must now be several thousand soldiers here, and she saw some kind of artillery parked under camouflage nets. They looked like long-barreled anti-aircraft guns. Further on, she noticed parked trucks with dish-shaped radar antennae pointed skyward, and she thought of her father and Gary bringing the Lear in overhead. There was no way to warn them of these changes. When they reached the beach compound, Isabella checked the distance registered on the speedometer. It was only 3.6 kilometers from the airstrip to the beach, much closer than she had estimated. She wondered just how this might endanger the rescue operation. Reinforcements could be rushed in more swiftly than Sean had allowed for. José carried her luggage into the guardhouse. Waiting for her were the same two women who had met her before. However, their attitude was friendlier and more informal. "I've brought you a gift," Isabella greeted them, and gave them each a bottle of perfume, which she had chosen for size rather than for subtle aroma. They were delighted, and sprayed themselves so liberally that the air in the room was difficult to breathe. It was some minutes before they could get around to searching Isabella's luggage. This time the camera was passed without comment, though they lingered longingly over her cosmetics. Isabella invited them to try a little of her lipstick, and they accepted with alacrity and admired the results in the mirror of Isabella's compact. The atmosphere was more that of a gathering of old friends than of a security screening. By the time they came to examine the box of gifts for Nicholas, their hearts were obviously no longer in the task. One of them picked out the deflated soccer ball. "Ah, Pile will like this," she cried. And then Isabella's nerves prickled with tension as she handled the pump. "For the ball," she explained. "See, I know, to pump the air." The woman gave it a few desultory strokes and then dropped the pump back into the box. "I am sorry to have inconvenienced you, Signora. We are only doing our duty." "Of course, I understand," Isabella agreed. "You will stay with us 2 weeks. That is good. Pilar has been very excited that you are coming. He is a good boy. Everybody likes him very much. Everybody is very proud of him." She helped Isabella to carry her cases across to the same hut that they had given her on her last visit. Nicholas was sitting on her bed, already in his swimming trunks. "Come, Mama, we'll go for a swim now. I will race you out to the reef." He swam like an otter, and she was hard-pressed to keep up with him. That evening, when just the two of them were alone in her hut, she gave him his gifts from the box. Although the soccer ball was the greatest gift, he also enjoyed her choice of books and clothes. She had brought a selection of colourful surfers' baggies and T-shirts, which delighted him. There was also a Sony cassette player and a box of music cassettes. His favourites were Creedence Clearwater Revival and the Beatles. "Can you rock and roll?" she asked. "I'll show you." And she put a Johnny Hallyday tape on the player. They gyrated around the hut in their bathing suits, shrieking with laughter, until Adra called them for dinner. Adra was as taciturn and withdrawn as ever, and Isabella ignored her and concentrated all her attention on Nicholas. She had stored up a selection of elephant jokes for him. "How do you know that the elephant has been in the refrigerator?" "You see his footprints in the butter." He loved that one. In return, he told her a joke that he had heard from José, the paratrooper. It left her gasping for air. "Do you know what that means?" she asked in nervous trepidation. "Of course," he told her. "One of the big girls at school showed me." And Isabella thought it prudent not to pursue the subject. After they had seen him to bed, Adra walked with her to the hut, and Isabella whispered, "Where is Ramon, the Marquês? Is he here?" Adra looked around carefully before replying. "No, he will come soon. I think tomorrow or the next day. He says he will come to you. He says to tell you he loves you." Alone in her hut, Isabella found that she was trembling at the prospect of meeting Ramon again, now that she knew him for what he was. She doubted whether she would be able to act naturally towards him. The thought of making love to him terrified her. Surely he would sense the change in her feelings towards him.
He might take Nicholas away or have her imprisoned. Please, God, let Sean reach me before Ramon does. Keep him away until Sean comes.
She lay awake that night, cold with dread that Ramon would suddenly appear out of the darkness, and she must take him into her bed. As before, she and Nicholas spent the next 2 days swimming and fishing and playing with 26 on the beach. The puppy had grown into a lanky, long-tailed, cross-eyed dog with floppy ears that Nicholas adored. It shared his bed with him. Isabella did not have the authority to forbid it, even though Nicholas's long legs were speckled with flea bites. On the Monday night, while she watched Nicholas prepare for bed, she reached up casually and took down the bicycle pump from the shelf above his bed, on which the new soccer ball held pride of place. She twisted the handle and heard the faint internal click as the transponder switched on. She replaced the pump on the shelf just as Nicholas came back from the bathroom, smelling of the peppermint toothpaste she had brought from Cape Town for him. As she leant over the bed to tuck in the mosquito net, he reached up unexpectedly and threw both arms around her neck. "I love you, Mama," he whispered shyly, and she kissed him. His mouth was soft and moist and warm and tasted of toothpaste, and she thought her heart would burst with love of him. Quickly embarrassed by his own display, Nicholas rolled over, pulled the sheet up to his chin, closed his eyes tightly, and made ostentatious snoring sounds. "Sleep well, Nicky. I love you too with all my heart," she whispered. As she walked back to her own hut, thunder growled and lightning flickered across the night sky. As she looked up, a heavy drop of warm rain struck her on the centre of her forehead. It was very quiet in the cockpit of the Lear. They were at 40,000 feet, almost service ceiling, as high as they could get for maximum endurance and speed. "Enemy coast ahead," Sharza said softly, and Gary chuckled. "Come on, Pater, people only say things like that in World War II movies." They were high above the cloud mass in a world of enchanted silver moonlight. The cloud below them shone with the peculiar brilliance of an alpine snowfield. 100 nautical miles to run to the mouth of the Congo River. Sharza checked their position on the screen of the satellite navigation system. "We should be almost exactly overhead Lancer's station." "Better give them a call," Gary suggested, and Sharza switched radio frequencies. "Hello, Donald Duck, this is Magic Dragon, do you read?" "Hello, Dragon, this is the Duck, reading you 10-10. The reply was immediate, and Sharza smiled with relief as he recognized his eldest son's voice. "Sean must have had his thumb on the button," he murmured, and keyed his microphone. "Stand by, Duck. We're heading for Disneyland." "Have a nice trip. Duck is standing by." Sharza swiveled into the co-pilot's seat and looked back into the Lear's passenger cabin. The two technicians from Courtney Communications were crouched over their equipment. It had taken them 10 days to install all the special electronics. Much of it was state-of-the-art equipment, which was still under test with Arms Corps, and had not yet been issued to the Air Force. It was not built into the Lear's body, but strapped and screwed to the cabin floor. Their intent faces were painted a witch's green by the glow from the display panel, and the enormous headphones distorted the shape of their heads. Sharza switched to the intercom. "How are you doing, Len?" The head engineer glanced up at him. "No radar, Lash. We're receiving normal radio traffic from Luanda, Kinshasa, and Brazzaville. No signal from the target." "Carry on," Sharza turned. He knew that the new frequency search equipment was skipping through the bands. It should pick up any military traffic from Luanda or Sarimo military bases. The antenna, mounted under the Lear's belly, would warn them if they were detected by hostile radar. Len, the radio engineer, had been chosen for his command of Spanish. He would be able to monitor any Cuban radio traffic. "Okay, Gary," Sharza touched his arm. "We're overhead the Congo mouth. Your new heading is 175. "New heading, 175. Gary stood the Lear on one wingtip as they turned east of south to run parallel with the coastline. By some freak of wind and weather, a deep hole opened in the cloud mass beneath them. The moon was directly overhead, and only 2 days from its full. Its light beamed down into the chasm, and 40,000 feet below they saw the platinum gleam of water and the dark shape of the African coast. Ambra's river mouth in 4 minutes, Sharza warned. We have initiated search for target signal, Len confirmed in his headphones. Overhead, Ambra's, Sharza intoned. No target signal received. Katanka river mouth in 6 minutes, Sharza said. He hadn't really expected the Ambra's to yield results. It was the outer limit of their search cone. He looked ahead and grimaced. Directly in their track, a gigantic mountain of menacing black cloud rose hammerhead into the stratosphere.